Hello, everybody. Bill Buckmaster with you, along with my buddy John, engineering and producing our program. Welcome to the Buckmaster Show. Tuesday, June 20th, 2023. Tomorrow, kickoff summer here in Tucson. Of course, summer comes a little earlier than usual. Not so fierce this year, but I think some of those temperatures we're seeing next week. 110 and climbing. Our show in our 13th year broadcasting from the Green Things Zocalo Village Studio, 1030 KVOI, Tucson's voice for trusted news and talk, worldwide live listening on my website, buckmastershow.com, where we piggyback the live feed from kvoi.com, our telephone interviews, our live line presented by Rincon Ventures Real Estate and Property Management. Researchers at the University of Arizona's Yuma Center of Excellence for Desert Agriculture are turning to wastewater monitoring to help defend against yet another emerging public health concern, the drug-resistant fungus Candida aureus. Joining us on the live line, Dr. Gabriel Innes. Dr. Innes is a visiting researcher at the University of Arizona and the primary epidemiologist translating wastewater research to public health action. Dr. Innes has worked to prevent and control hospital-acquired infections, including Candida aureus, in New Jersey for 2 years, and has conducted dozens of outbreak investigations to control these bad bugs. Gabriel, how are you, sir?
Hey, how's it going, Bill, John?
Pretty darn good. So, bad bugs. How serious is Candida aureus?
Yeah, let's abbreviate it C. aureus. It's a mouthful, Candida aureus. C. aureus, and let me first say thank you for having me and talking about this important subject. C. aureus, for most individuals, isn't that bad of a bug. But for people who are immunocompromised or have other illnesses, people in the hospital, you know, we all have loved ones and friends in long-term care settings. When this bug sort of infiltrates this area, these long-term care centers and hospitals, it has the propensity to cause really bad infections, and it can cause bloodborne infections and even cause death among individuals.
That's pretty darn scary. Is it contagious?
Yeah, that's a great question. So Candida aureus has the ability to survive for long periods of time in the environment. So unlike COVID or other respiratory illnesses, Candida aureus isn't through respiratory sputum or, you know, coughing and sneezing and things like that. It's usually caused through touch. So individuals in the healthcare center, if they have this organism, and many times people don't even know they have it, other people who touch them, interact with them, if they're not using gloves and hand washing, it's easy to spread it from one individual to another. So being really conscientious about sticking to those fundamentals, you know, hand washing, protection in the hospital setting is so crucial to prevent the spread of this organism.
So it sounds like it could be a risk to those of us who are healthy.
But for those of us who are healthy, actually, we do a pretty good job in terms of our own. You know, we're covered with bacteria. We're covered with fungi, as gross as it is. But a lot of these bacteria and bugs on us protect us, and our body protects us as well. And so if we're healthy, then oftentimes the bacteria and our natural flora, it's called, or the bacteria on our body, are able to outcompete Candida aureus in very many cases. And so we don't get sick. But for people who are sick, oftentimes their body and the bacteria and the fungus on their body themselves are also not as good at protecting their insides as much as healthy individuals.
This whole wastewater area of epidemiology, I'm mispronouncing that, I'm sure, is really,
oh, right.
Yeah, it's growing, isn't it?
It is. It is a really exciting field, honestly. So we're able to, through our wastewater, so through municipal water, when we all go to the bathroom, we're able to see people in an aggregate form, so the community level. We're able to look at the concentration of some of these organisms, or so viruses, germs, even chemicals. And we can determine whether a number of individuals in a community are sick. And when we understand this, we can help educate or inform public health officials to be able to put in place, health alert notifications out to the community to help them understand what's going on and to protect themselves.
This was used a lot during, and probably still is, during the COVID-19 epidemic, wasn't it, Dr. Innes?
You're absolutely right. So although wastewater-based technology isn't new, it has been reinvigorated during the COVID-19 pandemic. And even now that we're in a new phase and the emergency declaration is no longer active, we're still monitoring COVID in our wastewater. And this, again, helps us determine there may be spikes in coronavirus cases that can help people, understand and help them protect themselves and help them protect their loved ones as well.
We're speaking with Dr. Gabriel Innes, a visiting researcher at the University of Arizona, the primary epidemiologist translating wastewater research to public health action. So we've talked about COVID and we've talked about Candida auris. Where does this research go from here, Dr. Innes?
Yeah, that's a great question. And this is one of the really exciting tools in our toolbox, so to speak, that in the grand scheme of things, we also have vaccination, we have testing. So this is another one of our tools that help us really understand how diseases are, coming into our community, affecting people, and when organisms like SARS-CoV-2 or COVID, as well as Candida auris, come into different communities. We're also looking at additional viruses. The flu is a big one that we're looking at. You may have heard RSV in the news recently that have been really affecting our young population, our young community members as well, children. And we're looking at new germs, new viruses, and chemicals as well. So actually, opioids can be looked at in the wastewater too. And this helps us understand if there are emergency responders that go into specific communities, if they need to know, what are the specific interventions that they can use? Are opioids, specific opioids used in these populations so they can come in with good interventions and be able to help people on the ground as effectively and quickly as possible?
Is it true that the wastewater is just full of people who've dumped out all of their old prescriptions and things they've dumped, something I think you shouldn't probably do, dumped it down the toilet? Is there any truth to that?
Yeah, we as public health officials, and you can go to Pima County or the Arizona Department of Health Services website to help with how to dispose of older, expired pharmaceutical drugs and medicines. And really, it shouldn't be dumped in the wastewater. It causes some unknown problems as well. And the correct way to discard these medicines is to go to a number of different sites. And it could be your local pharmacy if they have collections. It could be your fire stations if they have local connections. So, yes, I'm with you 100%. People should not be dumping their medicines in the wastewater.
All right, Dr. Gabriel Innes, visiting researcher at the University of Arizona, primary epidemiologist translating wastewater research to public health action. Dr. Innes, thank you very much, sir.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
All right. Take a break right here. It's the Buckmaster Show, Tuesday edition. Shelley Fishman with me in studio, and down, down, down goes the thumb. And we'll find out what's going on Wall Street. And Shelley will be with us right after this. Family-owned Jam Culinary Concepts and its family of restaurants has you covered for your special event. Jam caters anytime, anywhere, any size group, and any type of cuisine. Vero Amore, authentic Neapolitan pizza, and Noble Hops. Craft beer and fine fare are synonymous with quality. Call 954-1468 or log on to jamculinaryconcepts.com. Buckmaster Show listeners know that I'm passionate about travel. When I'm ready to take off on a new adventure, my air travel begins and ends at Tucson International Airport. TUS is nonstop for our community and Southern Arizona. So remember, to fly local, fly Tucson. Tucson International is nonstop for Tucson. More at flytucson.com.
The Regional Transportation Authority's 20-year plan includes roadway, transit, pedestrian, bicycle, and many other transportation improvements across the region. Pima County voters approved the plan in 2006, and the RTA is working with the Citizens Advisory Committee to prepare and present a new draft plan as early as 2023 for public review. Learn more about the process at rtanext.com.
Family-owned and run since 1985, Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing is the gold standard for quality and professionalism for picture framing, custom frame mirrors, art for your walls, and hanging and lighting solutions. Come in for your design session or set it up electronically. Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing, Fort Lowell and Dodge, and now doing e-commerce at moesgallery.com.
Have you always wanted to cruise to Alaska? If that's the case, then you'll only see the tip of the iceberg. At Bon Voyage Travel, we can package the full Alaska experience with a cruise tour. Journey to Denali National Park on glass-domed rail cars. Tour the tundra wilderness and see the northern lights with an expert guide. And of course, relax on your cruise as you enjoy the glaciers up close and personal. Go to bvtravel.com today. Bon Voyage Travel, your Alaska experts.
Cushman & Wakefield Picor is Tucson's leading independently owned full-service commercial real estate company. Founded in 1985, Cushman & Wakefield Picor offers leasing, sales, and property management for industrial, office, medical, retail, land, and investment properties in Tucson and Sonora, Mexico. Visit our website at picor.com for the latest news from Tucson's commercial real estate sector. That's picor.com. Call us at 748-7100.
Shelley Fishman is a financial consultant in private practice in Tucson, Arizona. The views expressed during this segment are his own and don't necessarily represent those of this station or of Bill Buckmaster Communications. Contact Shelley through buckmastershow.com or at shelleyfishman.com.
And here he is, Mr. Shelley Fishman. Shell, how are you?
I am well. It's Tuesday, so, you know.
Yeah, it but, just seems like, I don't know, we should probably chart it sometimes. Going back our many, many years together here on the show, how Tuesdays have sometimes been a rather, let's say, a letdown for us on
right,
Wall Street.
Right. However, last week we got more good news on the economy. The Fed stopped for at least the time being its interest rate increases, as we said they would do. The Fed, in the form of the Fed Chair, Jay Powell, gave us a slap on the wrist and said, don't think that just because we're stopping for now that this means we're not going to raise in the future. So, you know, he kept all of his options open. The market reacted very, very well. Mm-hmm. And unless I'm mistaken, the Dow is still over 34,000. So
wow.
We're in officially in, as the strict definition would be, we're in a bull market territory. But I don't define it that way. The low was a very brief low. We're up 20% from that. Let's not call this a bull market yet. This is a market that's searching around to see if it can understand this silly economy of ours.
Let's put it this way. Might be on the edge of a bull market.
I'll go with that.
So do we have any idea when the bear market, how long the bear market's been around? What's your guess of
how many
months?
It lasted like 2 days. I mean, yeah, you know, and then it came back off the 20% level. So we never really had, you know, a howling bear.
Okay.
And this is not yet a raging bull. So let's just, as investors, really take this in a very conservative way. The overall arc of the economy has not really changed. We have some headwinds that you and I will discuss later on in this segment. But what investors are saying is that the rate of corporate profits, the rate of hiring, the rate of spending on the part of Americans, and in fact worldwide, and the way inflation is coming under control are all very positive. And the likelihood of even a mild recession later on in this year is you know, only the alarmists are calling for that.
The new economic model, and it's here. We've talked about it, Shelley. I think I characterized it as a hybrid kind of economy. We really shouldn't be surprised coming out of the worldwide pandemic and then looking at how integrated the world is.
And that's exactly right, Bill. That's a very good point. So starting around the mid-1980s, we started deregulating corporations. We started lifting regulations that had been in place very often for decades and giving corporations the ability to make decisions on their own about where and how they would manufacture. We've known since the 1960s that certain industries had a propensity to offshore their, you know, what their manufacturing. And so the so-called Rust Belt, you know, had been around certainly since the late 60s, early 70s. I remember working up in the Boston area in what had been a heavily industrialized area. And it was just one closed factory after the other. And that was in the early 70s. But certainly once we started lifting regulations and let corporations make worldwide decisions without really forcing them to look at the implications for our domestic economy and our domestic employment, corporations went and did that. And so a lot of stuff that had been manufactured here in the United States, or, you know, when we talk about Europe and other industrialized nations, stuff that had been locally manufactured started to migrate to places where the manufacturing costs were much, much lower.
Bangladesh,
China.
Usual suspects.
India, yeah. Usual suspects. The effects of that overall on the economy for at least 40 years were very, very positive for most people. Now, there were losers. We knew there would be winners and losers, but most economists trusted that open markets, free markets, would make rational decisions that in the long run would work to the advantage of everybody involved.
Mm-hmm.
And if we take a look at the statistics worldwide, in fact, worldwide poverty during that period of time came down from something like 30% down to 8 or 9% of the populations. And so it seemed to be working, unless you happen to be working in a factory that got closed and you didn't have the skills to go anywhere else. And that was a heck of a lot of people, even here in the States. So, you know, there were people who were reacting negatively to the idea of globalization for a long time and were subject to the kind of propaganda that you get mostly from the right, you know, saying that
one world government
is a bad idea, that it's all communist, that immigration is a bad thing. So we got that, and that started to really annoy people and worry people. But we didn't see the effects of that as strongly as we might have until two things happened in the past couple of years that have really called into question the efficiency of the wise markets and the rational markets. And the first was the pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
And what that did is expose the vulnerabilities in our supply chains. So stuff that we thought, you know, wasn't a big deal. So the Chinese are making most of our masks, or the Taiwanese are making most of our, you know, computer chips, or, you know, the Indians are making most of our prescription medication. All of a sudden, with the pandemic, those supply chains became very vulnerable from a couple of perspectives. Number one, they became vulnerable because we couldn't offload the stuff that was coming into our ports. But also, as countries like China literally shut down their economies, it was shutting down the manufacturing that the rest of the world had become dependent upon. So that was one thing. The other thing was, and I don't want to blame just Russia for this, but there are countries out there who have a history of trying to exert their hegemony over their neighbors. Certainly the USSR tried to do it through, you know, all of the time from I guess, you know, you'd say the mid-30s through the war and then, you know, through the dropping of the Iron Curtain on Eastern and Central Europe.
50 years anyway, 50 years
exactly. Mm-hmm. And the Chinese had also a history of wanting to influence their neighbors to their predominance.
Sphere of influence.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Mm-hmm. What the war in Ukraine has done is shown that countries might be able to get away with that.
Mm-hmm.
And we've seen actors who could very well have, you know, sit back and enjoy their prosperity. I mean, for a decade or more, the Chinese economy was growing at 12% a year.
Yeah.
When the rest of the world was growing at 3% a year. I mean, what is it about, you know, prosperity you don't get?
Yes.
But instead, the Chinese have viewed this as a competition, some, you know, unto the death, if you will. They had to, they didn't have to, but they chose to shut down their economy during the pandemic, and they have chosen not to make their markets available to imports from the rest of the world. That has made the partnership with China really look one-sided. And, you know, we kind of looked away from that until the pandemic and the war.
And so that might be one of the silver linings.
Well, it
certainly brought home the fact that we cannot rely 100% on some of these so-called partners or one-time partners.
Exactly. So the integration of the world economy mm-hmm. is really under threat right now. You see it with, for instance, Ukraine was the largest exporter of grains mm-hmm. In the world. And with the war there, that has really thrown those people, those countries that have relied upon imports of food from Ukraine, that has threatened them.
Mm-hmm.
There's another factor that really, you know, makes this kind of wonkish, but global warming has now changed climates to the point of people needing to migrate out of areas that are no longer habitable.
Sustainable,
exactly. Mm-hmm. And so this integrated economy, world economy, this globalization is beginning to look a little more fragile than we thought it was. Mm-hmm. And it's beginning to get to that degree of susceptibility to outside forces, to worldwide forces, more quickly than our policymaking as, you know, an industrialized West, if you will, is able to catch up with it and able to make policies. First of all, we have a lot of divisions within not only our country, but in Europe, European countries, so that there's a blame game going on instead of a real desire to work together to find out what we can do to fix this problem. The globalization isn't going away. It's not going to stop completely. We're beginning to bring more stuff on board in country manufacture, but that's going to take some time to complete. In the meantime, more and more people are feeling disadvantaged. The price discounts that allowed people in the middle class to believe that they were still in the middle class, even though in fact maybe they weren't, that with the supply chain problems and inflation has now caused alarm among the lower tiers of earners. And so we're getting this anger, and we have lost the habit of being able to negotiate with our trading partners in a productive and, you know, self-serving way. We've got to get that back. But so long as we're pointing fingers at each other and trying to blame rather than find solutions, this is a real problem. And so for investors, making some sort of assessment as to how we view the changes that are going to happen and whether those changes will work to the advantage of investors or will work to the disadvantage of stable economies is something that I think the jury's still out on.
Still to come, as they say.
Absolutely.
All right, Shelley Fishman, thank you, Shell. Have a great day.
You too, Bill.
All right, take a break right here, back after this.
Take out authentic Neapolitan wood-fired pizza at Vero Amore, where every flavorful pizza, pasta, and panini are homemade using the finest local and imported ingredients. Vero Amore, Plaza Palomino at Swan and Fort Lowell, and on Dove Mountain in Marana, plus a full catering menu and mobile pizza truck for parties and events. Vero Amore, on the web at veroamorepizza.com. For more than a half century, Tucson Gardeners Trust Green Things, a family-owned and operated retail and wholesale plant nursery, offering an amazing variety of plants, trees, cacti, pottery, and so much more, all at great prices. The 13.5-acre site by the Rito River is also home to the Zocalo Village, specializing in fine Mexican and Latin American imported furniture and art. Green Things open daily at 3384 East River Road and at greenthingsaz.com and zocalovillage.com.
Hi, this is Irene Coppola, President and CEO of the Better Business Bureau serving Southern Arizona. The BBB sets the standards for marketplace trust by engaging with and educating consumers and businesses. The BBB is the resource to turn to for the objective, unbiased information on businesses offering national and local consumer services online and in person. Learn more about the many services offered by the Better Business Bureau at bbb.org.
This is Bill Buckmaster urging my listeners to join me in becoming a member of the Reed Park Zoo, one of America's top zoos and home to more than 300 animals from all over the world. When you become a zoo member, you receive free daytime admission, discounts on special events and education programs, and so much more. Find out more about zoo membership and everything you need to know about your zoo visit, reedparkzoo.org.
The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun cover two of Arizona's most desirable communities. The newspapers reach more than 75% of the communities each week, with a combined population of more than 50,000. The Green Valley News also publishes a dozen magazines each year, and both newspapers publish up-to-the-minute local news online at gvnews.com. The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun, it's all right here.
Nestled in the foothills of the Santa Rita Mountains of southeastern Arizona is Equine Voices and Sanctuary, home to horses and burros that were rescued from neglect, abuse, abandonment, and slaughter. Please consider Equine Voices Rescue and Sanctuary with a financial gift of support and estate remembrance. Learn more about our vision and values at equinevoices.org.
Welcome back. It is the Buckmaster Show, Tuesday edition. We love Green Thing. We love all of our wonderful sponsors. Green Thing's 3384 East River Road by the Rito River. Just west of the Brandy Fenton Park, 13-acre site, chock full of everything you could imagine for your garden. And garden accessories, they're part of the business called Zocalo Village. They got you covered. GreenThingsAZ.com and ZocaloVillage.com, the websites. They're in their 53rd year of business. Summer's upon us. I thought this would be a good opportunity. Kind of kick back for a half an hour. Talk about what's on your summer reading list. I've invited a couple of gentlemen who love to read, and they do some literary reviews. They're just, I think, locally the best in their particular area. That's why I've called upon them. Writer, journalist, editor, photographer, publisher, Gregory McNamee, who is the author of 8 books, including Tortillas, Tiswin, and T-Bones, A Food History of the Southwest, and Gila, The Life and Death of an American River. Mr. McNamee is editor of Zocalo, an arts and culture magazine covering Tucson and Southern Arizona. He's also the operator of Sonoran Word Works, an editorial and publishing service. So we've got Greg with us, seated to my right, and Bruce Dingus, our old friend, retired, not old, he's still, Bruce, you look like when I first met you 30 years ago. Well, maybe not 30 years ago.
You lie, but thank you.
Yeah, we know. We've known Bruce Dingus. We've known Bruce a long time. He retired from the Arizona Historical Society, where he was editor of the Journal of Arizona History. He was also one of the judges. Greg's been a judge, too. Greg, you continue to be a judge for the Southwest Books of the Year competition.
Yes.
But Bruce, I'm guessing at this when I wrote this introduction, more than 3 decades, would that be about right?
Yes.
Southwest Books of the Year?
Yes.
Yeah, so anyway, you've sort of stepped aside for that for a little bit, but wouldn't surprise me if you come back. Anyway, Greg and Bruce, great to have you both.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Bill.
Good
to be here.
I asked you guys to compile a list of some ideas for some summer reading. Why don't we begin with you, Greg? This is not necessarily going by, this is the number one recommendation, but maybe it is. What's on the list?
Yeah, I don't know that this is number one, but Cormac McCarthy, who's the great Southwestern novelist, Blood Meridian, in my opinion, is the great Southwestern novel. And when he died last week, people were talking about Hemingway and Faulkner and all kinds of comparisons. But I want to suggest another tie, and that's to a writer named Charles Portis, who is the author of a very cynical, very violent, very fun true novel called True Grit. And you probably remember the story from the John Wayne movie.
I do. And I saw the movie.
Yeah.
And the remake of the movie, which I thought was pretty good.
Well, the original was a little bit cleaned up. And one of the ways in which it was cleaned up is that Rooster Cogburn, the U.S. Marshal that a young 14 or 15-year-old girl named Maddie Ross hires, was a writer with William Quantrill's Raiders, Confederate guerrillas during the war. And he's a hard drunk in this. And he winds up, there's none of the noble gunfighter in him. He shoots people in the back. He's just not a nice guy. And he ends his days in a Wild West show with former comrades of his, Cole Younger and Frank James, the brother of Jesse James. Maddie Ross says, "These old timers lived dangerous lives, and now this was all they were fit for, to show themselves to the public like strange wild beasts of the jungle." Well, anyway, True Grit is part of a new collection of Charles Portis's complete fiction. He wrote 5 novels. The other 4 are just as good as True Grit, but I would say if you had to read just one of them, True Grit would be the one.
All right, Bruce, let's kick you into the picture here.
I want to start by echoing what Greg said about Cormac McCarthy. If you have one book to read this summer, read Blood Meridian. As Greg says, it is, in my mind, too, the great American or a great Southwestern novel, and McCarthy's just an unparalleled writer, so treat yourself. My list begins with Timothy Egan, A Fever in the Heartland, the Ku Klux Klan's plot to take over America and the woman who stopped them. Historians rightly tend to focus on the rise of the Ku Klux Klan as an organization formed to terrorize newly freed blacks in the post-Civil War South. So it's easy to forget the Klan's resurgence in the 1920s as a white supremacist Christian nationalist party that threatened to dominate state and local politics, particularly in the Midwest and the Rocky Mountain states. Enter D.C. Stevenson, a charismatic con man who rose rapidly to control the Indiana Klan and seemed poised to assume leadership of the national hate movement until a young woman named Madge Oberholzer exposed him for the soulless charlatan that he was, and in the process destroyed the entire organization. In telling Oberholzer's story, Egan reminds us of violent undercurrents in American politics that reverberate down to the present day.
So then again, see if I can. The name of this is published by Viking, A Fever in the Heartland, the Ku Klux Klan's plot to take over America, and the woman who stopped them.
Right.
All right. Back to you, Greg.
Well, not to sound too highfalutin, but every summer I take on what I call a project book, which is one that takes some effort to read. It's kind of like, you know, doing homework, because summer school, right?
Sure.
So last summer it was Shakespeare, and the summer before that it was Virginia Woolf. And this year it's a book I'm rereading, and that's James Joyce's Ulysses, which is the Cambridge edition, published by Cambridge University Press in a large format. Contains the original 1922 text and a lot of explanatory notes, and it's what they call a cat squasher. You know, if you threw it at a cat, you wouldn't have that cat anymore. So it's not exactly right for beach baggage or, you know, carry-on luggage or anything like that. But if you read a few pages a day, you'll knock it out by September, and then you'll be ready for next year's 120th anniversary of the action in the book, which takes place on June 16th, 1904. So you'll be all ready for it. You'll have bragging rights for finishing a challenging book. You get to show off to your friends, and besides, it's one of the best novels ever written.
So that's a project book, isn't it? James Joyce. How about Barbara Kingsolver? I'm going to keep it with you, Greg. Barbara's got this is her latest book. A lot of people are talking about it. Damon Copperhead?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Demon Copperhead.
Demon.
A little anecdote. I went to grad school with Barbara, and she lived in the grad dorm at the university, and I had friends there. And so on Saturday nights, I'd go over and, you know, sit at the pool and drink beer and hang out with my friends. In the meanwhile, you could hear Barbara up in her room clacking away on her typewriter. And
what year
that's
is that?
Why this when, is what? In the late 70s.
Okay.
Yeah. And, so that's why she won a Pulitzer Prize and I didn't, I think, you know, as I was down at the pool drinking beer instead of applying myself. Well, Barbara won the Pulitzer for Demon Copperhead, which is a very clever book set in rural Appalachia today, which is her native country. It's a very subtle reworking, speaking of classic books, of David Copperfield, Charles Dickens's David Copperfield. I have to say, I don't think it's her best novel, but it's provocative and very well written, and it's entertaining all at the same time, and there's enough action to get you through an airplane flight to Lisbon or Fiji or wherever it is that the summer's going to take you.
All right, Bruce Dingus, let's do a couple with you before we take the break. Why don't we begin with one that I've read and highly recommend. Well, I love Tom Zollner's work. This is a book that he's University of Arizona Press, and it's called Rim to River, Looking into the Heart of America. We had Tom with me, actually. We had him as a Friday Focus interview. I think we spent the whole hour with Tom, and I probably could have spent a whole day with Tom Zollner. But I like pretty much everything he's written. In fact, even his book about the diamond trade. I'm still kind of in the middle of that book. But go ahead with Tom's latest book.
Yeah,
some of
Tom's
your thoughts.
Sort of a hidden treasure.
He is.
More people need to know about him. Tom's actually a Canyon Del Oro high school grad
yeah,
and former Arizona Republic reporter. And in this book, he sets out on an epic hike from the Grand Canyon to the site of an 18th century silver strike in northern Mexico, searching for the soul of his native state. The result will enlighten, perhaps surprise many readers. Along the trail, he is constantly struck by Arizona's natural beauty juxtaposed with its embrace of extremist politics, economic greed, and callous treatment of minority groups, including the poor and the elderly. If his feelings are conflicted, so too are his hopes. And in this version of Tough Love, he posits that only when we admit to our shortcomings can we achieve our potential. So he holds out hope for Arizona, even though it exasperates him sometimes.
Yeah, let's try to work in one more. This is a gentleman I've had the pleasure, really, I think I interviewed Luis Urrea with one of his, was it something, the book about snow? What was the title?
In Search of Snow.
He came on the show on when I was doing Arizona Illustrated. That might have been like the late 1980s or early. Mm-hmm. Could have been one of his first books, but I cherish that autograph copy that I have. But that's on the list, his new book published by Little Brown, Bruce Dingus. It's called Good Night, Irene.
Yeah, well, I'll echo what you just said. In Search of Snow is one of my favorite Luis books. It's a lot of fun. It's about wrestlers in Arizona and all the good things. But now he's come out with a different book. It's called Good Night, Irene. And it's really kind of a surprise, an entertaining one. It's based on his mother's World War II experiences with the Red Cross's donut dollies, boosting the morale of Allied soldiers in England and Europe. Fleeing from an abusive relationship, Irene Woodward joins the American Red Cross Clubmobile Corps, where she and her newfound friend Dorothy follow General George Patton's Third Army from Normandy beaches through the Battle of the Bulge to the liberation of the Buchenwald concentration camp. And through their eyes, readers experience the horrors of war interspersed with fleeting intervals of humanity and grace. Based on personal interviews and 25 years of research, Urrea tells us that he originally intended this to be a nonfiction book. This sensitive portrait of men and women at war stands as a beautiful homage to his mother and a moving tribute to the almost unimaginable sacrifices made by America's greatest generation. It's a beautiful piece of work.
He's a good guy. He's all over the place. He's a Facebook friend and been following where he's been traveling. I mean, he goes cross country for a book signing. He did a book signing in Santa Cruz, California. I mean, he goes to these places that he feels very comfortable in. I mean, but he's gets these great crowds. People mm-hmm. love him.
Yeah, they send me to Eloy, but they send him to Hawaii.
Greg McNamee is with us, and Bruce Dingus will continue. It's the Bookmaster Show. Be right back talking summer books right after this.
Noble Hops is Tucson's original gastropub, serving an ever-changing menu of craft beer and fine fare. Savor the majestic mountain views from the perfect for any season spacious patio at West Lambert Lane and North La Cañada Drive in Oro Valley. Order in or take out at Noble Hops, a pub for foodies. On the web at noblehops.com.
International Airport, we are nonstop for our community. Our main priorities are providing a safe and secure travel experience and excellent customer service. We are also nonstop for landing prosperity in Southern Arizona by attracting new flights for business travel and family getaways. When your airport thrives, our community thrives. So fly local, fly TUS. Tucson International Airport is nonstop for Tucson.
The Regional Transportation Authority plan is funded by a voter-approved half-cent sales tax. The RTA tax is collected throughout Pima County and averages about $100 million in revenue each month. The RTA is the largest annual funder of regional transportation projects in the region. The RTA tax funds priority projects that were approved by voters in 2006. See details in the latest RTA annual report at rtamobility.com.
Are you happy with the news you get? While not all news is good news, you know good reporting when you see it. Check TucsonSentinel.com every day for breaking news and investigative reports. And your say in the comments. It's all in TucsonSentinel.com, your local, independent, nonprofit news. You can rely on TucsonSentinel.com for solid reporting about immigration, Tucson and Pima politics, everything from the border to baseball. It's independent news without the spin. TucsonSentinel.com. We are watching Tucson.
The nonprofit Tucson Wildlife Center has been helping injured, sick, and orphan wildlife in southern Arizona since 1999. They're dedicated to the rescue, medical care, and rehabilitation of sick, injured, and orphan wildlife, with the goal of releasing them back to their natural habitat. Around 5,000 animals a year come to them, as they are the only wildlife rescue in southern Arizona. All made possible through donations. They receive no government funding. Please donate at TucsonWildlife.com.
The Friends of Pima Animal Care Center is the nonprofit partner to our Pima County Animal Shelter. We grant critically needed resources to PACC so that it can continue the amazing life-saving progress it has made in recent years. Your generosity helps us find homes for abused, neglected, and abandoned animals at PAC. Learn how you can help at friendsofpacc.org.
This is Kate Delaney. Tune in later tonight as we talk about everything that happened throughout your day. Tonight at 10 on 1030 KVOI, The Voice.
Welcome back. It is the Buckmaster Show, one of our great sponsors. I love them all. Silver City and Grant County, New Mexico. We send so many of the Buckmaster Show listeners over to this beautiful area of the Land of Enchantment. Start your planning now. It's only about a three-hour drive. Visit southwestnewmexico.org for all sorts of great information about what to do. And there are many recreational opportunities, great places to stay and dine as well. We continue our review of some summer books, ideas for folks that are thinking of heading off to the beach or the mountain, and have their book bag at the ready. Writer, journalist, editor, photographer, and publisher Greg McNamee is with us. Speaking of the Gila and Silver City, one of his books, Gila, The Life and Death of an American River. Greg, you love that area, don't you?
I do indeed, yeah. It's just one of the splendid places on Earth.
Bruce Dingus is here as well. Bruce retired from the Arizona Historical Society. He's editor of the Journal of Arizona History. And both Greg and Bruce have had a long relationship with Southwest Books of the Year, that competition, which has been going on, I don't know, 35 years maybe? No, longer?
I was there 36. So
30, okay. Well, maybe 40 years.
Yeah.
All right, we're talking about Bruce Dingus, Melissa Sevenet, Brave the Wild River, The Untold Story of Two Women Who Mapped the Botany of the Grand Canyon. This book is published by Norton. It's getting all sorts of fantastic reviews. I follow Melissa on Facebook, and New York Times had a great review on it, and she's all over the place with this book.
Good for her. She should be. I never thought I'd use the words botany and page turner in the same sentence, but here we are. Sevenet, a science reporter for Flagstaff's NPR station, tells the all-but-forgotten story of Elzeta Clover and Lois Jotter, the first women to successfully navigate the Colorado River through Grand Canyon. Although the novelty attracted plenty of media attention in 1938 and now, Sevenet makes clear that their trip served a serious scientific purpose, expanding knowledge of the canyon's unique ecosystem and advancing inquiry into how it evolved. Of course, there were adventures aplenty along the way. Sevenet just simply writes like an angel, whether she's describing swift runs through roiling rapids or fixing Clover and Jotter's significant place among the mostly male roster of Canyonland pioneers. It's just another great Grand Canyon book, of which there are plenty.
Greg, Joy Harjo spent some time here in the Tucson area. You like one of her books. I assume it's a relatively new book.
Published,
by Norton.
Yeah, brand new. Joy taught here for a while. The powers that be at the U of A let her slip away without granting her tenure. And of course, she went on. Yeah. Well, of course, she went on to become poet laureate of the United States. Not anything to sneeze at.
No.
But her new book is called Weaving Sundown in a Scarlet Light, and it has the subtitle 50 Poems for 50 Years, and 50 years at which she's been working away as a poet. And I'd just like to read a few lines from her poem, She Had Some Horses. She had horses who called themselves horse. She had horses who called themselves spirit and kept their voices secret and to themselves. She had horses who had no names. She had horses who had books of names. She had some horses. So,
very nice.
Intriguing poet.
Joy Harjo.
Intriguing poet.
Speaking of names, we know Paul McCartney, Greg. What's the book he's got out here?
Well, if you're old codgers like us, you'll probably remember where you were on February 9th, 1964.
I was watching the Ed Sullivan Show.
Me too. Me too, I think, and everybody else in America was in front of a black and white console watching the Beatles' debut appearance. Well, and if you live in Tucson and you haven't gotten there already, Paul McCartney's late wife, Linda McCartney, who is a Tucsonan, has a photo exhibit at the Center for Creative Photography. Brilliant, brilliant work. She was a great photographer. As it turns out, though, so was Sir Paul. And in 1964, while we were watching TV, he was out with a new Pentax camera taking photographs of the boys on tour and other things, and including America in a time when change was on the way. 1964, it's a very different America from the one we know today. And seen through Sir Paul's eyes as a young man at the time, 22, I guess, at the time, it's an America that's hopeful and alive.
Yep. The land, well, Camelot was still around. Of course, we had the assassination of Kennedy in 63, but the echoes of Camelot were still alive, Greg, for sure. All right, quickly, running out of time, but Bruce Dingus, turn now to a book titled His Majesty's Airship, The Life and Tragic Death of the World's Largest Flying Machine. I'm intrigued.
As am I. Years ago, George Blessinger owned the Texaco station, which is now Sparkle Cleaners up on Campbell Avenue, south of Glen, recalled for me the day as a child he watched the Graf Zeppelin pass over Tucson on its way across the continent to San Diego. And his description captured the lingering romance of dirigible passenger flight. Gwen, who's the author of the best-selling Empire of the Summer Moon, reminds us what a profoundly bad idea powered hydrogen-filled balloon flight was. Through the story of the British airship R-101, the largest ever flown, that crashed in flames in 1930 near Paris on its maiden voyage from London via Cairo to New Delhi, India, killing all but three of the crew members and passengers. The cast of colorful characters include a dashing dipsomaniac RAF officer, the Air Fleet's ambitious and romantically besotten director, the airship's doubting but faintly obedient chief engineer, and a competent crew helpless in the face of the unyielding laws of physics. All of this is part of a grandiose scheme to link the far-flung reaches of the British Empire. It's a compelling jazz-age tale, a persistent and ultimately fatal hubris in which hope and ambition explode in a gigantic hydrogen fireball.
Well, that sounds like it's going on my summer book list. That sounds very intriguing. We're out of time. Greg, if there was one book we didn't cover, can you give us the title of it at least?
Yeah, very quickly, a book called Banana Ball, which is the unbelievably true story of the Savannah Bananas, a grade Z baseball team that has made baseball fun in a way that Major League Baseball is trying to do but can't get done.
Very cool.
If you catch a ball in the stands, if you're a fan, that's an out. A runner can steal from the plate to first.
Wow.
It's a zippy game, and we need to have it here in Tucson.
All right, Greg McNamee, thank you very much, Greg, and Bruce Dingus. Guys are great.
Thank you, Bill.
Thanks, right, Bill.
That's going to do it for the Buckmaster Show. Thanks, John, on the other side of the glass. Hope everybody has a great afternoon.